outside and from the inside out. And I've been paying some attention to this. Well, I always endeavor to pay attention to it. But I have been in a conversation with myself and on some level with friends about the impacts underlying to the level of stress that we encounter in our lives today. And there's a lot going on in the news. I'm less concerned, though, in this moment with what's going on in the news, but what's going on and how that impact is being felt internally. And it's based on my own experience very often that I begin to explore these topics. And over the last several years, it seems to actually have gone quickly in retrospect. Perhaps that's because there were so many outside distractions and serious distractions with the COVID crisis. And then we were drawn into the election. And then we were drawn into more COVID crisis. And we started being impacted by the opening up of society again. And as a result of some of the lockdowns, these economic challenges. And then we've been drawn into the so-called war in Ukraine. I say so-called only because I don't know who's at war. Is it the U.S. or is it Ukraine? I'm not convinced of either. But actually, for someone who's not talking about the world, I'm talking a lot about the world. But mostly to speak of the impact of all of these changes on our internal systems, our nervous system, our capacity to sustain a healthy perspective on life and on the world. And generally speaking, I have thought that I had a good handle on this kind of thing. I thought, I have my meditation, I have my Qigong, I have my family and friends, I have the ability to speak with people on the radio. So I have many blessings, one might say, that I have had access to as a mechanism of coping with all of these changes. But as I am in the process of resuming a lifestyle that is outwardly mobile and engaging, I find that I still have a lot of hesitation about embracing the fact that the world is back to normal. And primarily, I think, because it's not. It's actually not back to normal. But there is the pressure there that we should re-engage with everything as if everything was normal. And I'm finding that this impulse of much of the world and of each of us individually to get back to our lives, it creates in me an anxiety, because all of my senses are telling me that actually things are not normal. And normal being a relative term, it could be just back to where it was 5 years ago, 7 years ago, 10 years ago, might seem more normal, though in many ways, not sure that normal is a reality. But one of the things we can count on is whatever our experience might be, that it will change. Things do change. And I think we've had a long spell of toxicity in our world, in our world of thinking, in our world of politics, and in our personal health and challenges to our health. So that leaves us all, to some degree, a bit strained. And it's hard for me to believe that not everyone is impacted in some way. And I know that there are many of us that can power through it, and that's how we get through things very often. We just keep putting one foot in front of the other. But I feel that at this particular moment in time, we have a window where we can be more reflective of the impact on our inner landscape. And so that's what I wanted to speak of today. And looking at how the nervous system works and how triggers are formed in our psychology that keeps us in these states of anxiety and fear beyond the actual emergency. And so from my vantage point, the actual emergency started, at least this phase of things, started with the COVID virus and the narratives around it. And I still find that the narratives around the COVID virus and the so-called remedies for the COVID virus are still in question. There's science that we can all look at and see what is being said, but the science doesn't always match the narrative. And I think that we've been inundated with a sense of fear over the whole episode of the COVID virus, which I must say we're still in. I just think that people have become more callous towards it. So as the information became more readily available, it became clear that some people with pre-existing conditions were more vulnerable than other people who were largely healthy and vital due to age, youth. And what began to occur socially is that rather than target treatment towards those communities that needed it the most, for whatever reasons, I'm sure we can come up with many, the whole society was targeted and everyone was bound to treat the risk the same, which engendered a kind of resentment from those people who ultimately came to understand that they weren't all that vulnerable as some others. And when we had medical doctors and researchers beginning to disseminate this information, rather than broadening the conversation, those voices were silenced, which created more suspicion and more fear and more vitriol over who was and wasn't conforming to the narrative being put into the stratosphere. So we started off with a lot of confusion. And then on top of that was the massive deaths that took place in the beginning, and this whole image of refrigerator vans outside of hospitals where people were dying and being put into these vans and how people were started to be separated from their families as they were ailing and dying. And there became a lot of breaking in the natural flow of what human communication would be on that level, as well as this ramping up of a fear-based thinking with regard to everyone being at the same risk. And as I did research, I discovered that part of the difficulty that was occurring was the narrative itself. And without having any true information, and you saw people in hospitals, walking into hospitals, being driven into hospitals, immediately being put on these intubation machines. And if you can remember, here in New York City, Governor Cuomo was on TV every day talking about we have to lower the risk to hospitals and make sure that we don't run out of resources. And we needed to purchase and place in all these machines, and people were discouraged from seeking help. And that discouraging of seeking help put people at greater risk themselves, because we come to find out that early treatment is a significant factor in survival. And the other thing that we learned is that the intubation machines were actually the mechanism through which people were losing their lives. And because people were not being calibrated according to their need. People who were talking and breathing had low oxygen but not lung problems were put on intubation machines. And because people were having trouble not having trouble breathing, their lungs were actually at that moment okay. The machines themselves were, in essence, exploding people's lungs. And this is what was happening in a lot of the hospitals. And the staff of the hospitals were also in a state of fear of getting the virus. And so people would walk into the hospitals. They wouldn't want to be close to them. They would put them on these machines, which involves putting muscle relaxants and putting people in comas so that they would be maintained on these machines. And then the tubing would go out the room and the staff would monitor the machines actually outside of the room. So all of this was based in fear, which I can forgive, because people didn't know. They were operating without having information. So the problem came when the information came and it was suppressed for extended periods of time. And it was a long time before the medical system came to understand that these machines had to be calibrated differently, and it was better to keep people off them at all costs, and it was more about moving the patient, getting the patient to strengthen the breathing. But also the other factor that came in was that the problem was not with the lungs' ability to breathe, it was a problem with clotting of the micro blood vessels of the lungs. And that's where the problem occurred. So after a time, they began to give steroids and blood thinners and other things that would prevent the blood clots from forming early. So there was a learning process, but it was very slow because of this need to maintain a narrative. So as this process was happening, there were many, many doctors who were researching and sharing notes across the whole world, conferencing, discovering what would work and wouldn't work. But ultimately, those very same physicians who came to discover and advance the treatment were then demonized because they were going against the conventional narrative. And so there were other things that have been and are still somewhat demonized, and that's the long COVID story of people who are having long-term impact and impact into the brain, impact into the heart, and impact into the whole body. And it came to real, the medical profession came to realize that the symptoms were not limited to the lungs. It wasn't a lung disease as such. So all that went down, and then everybody was kept in lockdown, however, until the virus came, the vaccine came. And then it was became a question of engineering everybody onto the vaccine, which was the panacea. It was going to cure all and save everyone's life. And then you take it down a few more months, and it's like, oh, well, actually, the vaccine wears off in 3 to 6 months. You got to get a refill. And then I think we're up to 4 now, 4 or 5 in some places. And it's not preventing the virus, yet the narrative is still everything is safe because, which seems to me, from my vantage point, to be economic. You know, a lot of people are making a lot of money from these systems that may help, but they clearly don't work in the way they were presented initially. And then comes the wave of people who are having some kind of response to the virus itself. And, you know, people either getting the virus, though they've been vaccinated 2, 3, 4 times, like Fauci was vaccinated 4 times and still came up with the virus and is recommending still that everyone should follow that path. But there are other complications. The all-cause death rates are up. There's an increase in myocarditis in younger people, especially men, going down into the teen years, up into the 40s and 50s. There are a lot of people experiencing problems with blood clots post vaccine in their lungs, in their legs, in various parts of the body. We see a lot of athletes dropping on the field. Now, I'm not ascribing any of these incidents. It could be entirely coincidence. But when you start to stack up the false narratives and the suppression of information, it leaves me personally in a very worrying state of mind. And this whole process has brought up in me a state of anxiety, which is not misplaced, I would say. I think there's real reason to be still anxious over what we're told and what we ultimately come to know about what we have been told. So from my vantage point, it makes it difficult for me personally, to re-engage fully in an external lifestyle where I'm out going to parties and to gatherings and even teaching. You know, I do Qigong online right now. I'm still a little reticent to go into an open space and teach. Not so much because I feel the risk is still high, but because of this underlying anxiety. And I began to want to confront this in myself, you know, not judgmentally so, but understanding that there's reasons for me to be experiencing anxiety about thinking of the world as a safe place to be in. And so I wanted to look into it more. And it's interesting because I've been using the techniques that I do in my classes, the breathing, the meditation, the movement, to calm the anxiety so that it's not really a problematic thing. I don't experience it as anxiety, but there's still this underlying reticence. So it led me to think that there's something deeper going on. And so I started looking at what has been going on with my family. So I have two of my brothers came up with COVID. The middle brother survived it, and the elder brother didn't. So my middle brother, living in Connecticut, had access to really good health care. He was in the hospital, and it was at a time when already knowledge had been gained about what works and what doesn't work. So he was never put on an intubation machine, but he was given oxygen rather than that. And he was given, all the different therapies that have been made available to those who have the best care. So people who have good health care would have had access to these things all along. People who are on managed care, Social Security, social services, never really had access to these other more revolutionary therapies. And so he survived because he was in a state that provides that to everyone. So if you're in Connecticut, good for you. My elder brother, who lived in Florida, however, was in a state that was, and still is to some degree, in denial about the whole thing. And he was an electrician, so he was working through the whole 2 years of the COVID crisis. But when they politically decided to throw that to the side and just opened up the state, sent everybody back to the beach, back to school, everyone went out there. Now, their COVID rates did go up when that happened, but they were not being reported to the same level. And it kind of fed into that political scenario of freedom. I want my freedoms. I want my rights. I don't want to wear a mask. I don't want to do this. I don't do want to do that. So in that period, and still true, a lot of people became exposed, got sick, and died. And my brother was one of these people in Florida who, as a result of his work and the opening up of the state, came down with COVID. But the response medically was the opposite, because there was, in my opinion, I'm not speaking of actual evidence, I'm speaking to my experience. He was not given medical care. He was essentially sent home. And so he was sent home with, I don't know what, maybe some pills of something or other. And within a couple of days, he transitioned. And so when I look at those two scenarios in my own experience, I begin to understand that that is the basis for my anxiety. Not that I don't believe that there are treatments that work. I do. I know that to be true. I also know that there are scenarios within which people don't have access to those revolutionary treatments. And that schism has left me with a massive anxiety about the whole thing. And if I split the difference, it means that I do things, I go out, I'm in the world, I meet friends, but I'm very cautious. If I'm going to be in a group, I'll wear a mask. If I'm in the train or transportation, I'll wear a mask. If I'm out in the air, I pull it off. I don't really wear it in air because air is what we need. And because I find that access to systems of care is so variable, the other part of my activities, I do a lot of research. What works, what doesn't work? What nutrients, how do you take those nutrients? So I put a lot of attention to it. So I, in my mind, I feel safe. I don't feel like I'm putting myself at risk. But that doesn't take away the anxiety and the impact to my nervous system that are occurred as a result of that whole scenario. And I suspect that there are many of us who, okay, we're moving on, we're going to work, we're doing what we need to do. Some folks are really comfortable and, you know, don't want to take precautions and they're still good. Some people take precautions and they still get sick. So it's still a bit of a mixed bag out there, but we can be pretty safe if we are well informed. But what to do about the anxiety? And that's where I wanted to get into an understanding of the parasympathetic nervous system and how that works. So I'm not a doctor, so I'll have to bring on someone, a medical advisor that can speak more definitively about how this works. But the way I understand it is the vagus nervous system, and vagus means wandering. So that means that it travels all around your body. So the vagus nervous system carries impulses from the brain into the body, and then the body sends its data back to the brain. And so the vagus nervous system is connected to the thalamus, the amygdala, the other parts of the brain, which I'm not going to really speak of because I don't know enough about them, but it connects to the stomach, the small intestine, the large intestine. And the way this system works is that the vagus nervous system is what educates the fight or flight system of the brain. So your body will have an experience of fear or danger, and that sensitivity will be transmitted through the vagus system of nerves to the brain. And the brain says, okay, when my person's heart beats at a certain level, it means that we're in danger. Or when my person's stomach starts to feel sour, or then I know that there is something wrong and we have to take action. When my person's intestines begin to cramp or pain or loosen, whatever is going on, that signal goes back to the brain, and the brain begins to accumulate these signals as symbols or symptoms of danger. And because we're dealing with an ancient system that's evolved through all of humanity, danger in ancient times might have been a tiger in the woods, and in which case this system is useful. But when it becomes sort of a generalized milieu or atmosphere within which we're living, then it becomes toxic. So this feedback system begins to work unconsciously, so that even with small triggers, it starts to pump up that anxiety and pump up that danger without really understanding why. Because there is no actual danger. We're just exposed on a daily basis to these conflicting narratives that we have to navigate. And so I have found that it's important to pay close attention to that reality. So even though I have been doing the work of the meditation and the breathing, there was something deeper that was persistent that caused me to have to deal with it on a continuous basis. And we can find signals within how we respond to things. Now, I tend to be an internally contemplative person, so my response generally is internalized. Another person who might be more outgoing and engaged and not thinking too much about what's going on the inside, their response might be externalized. So it might have an impact on how they treat people, how they talk to people, how they judge people, how they need to control people to be safe. And to me, that looks like what's happening in social media, where people are jumping on each other and dissing each other and ridiculing each other. And that could easily be driven by this internal system, parasympathetic nervous system, people being triggered to attack, to be defensive, like they would if there were a tiger or a lion in the brush. But the other people become that dangerous, predatory thing. And so I think that might be happening on a societal level with this toxic interchange and exchange between people and family members and people fighting each other and condemning each other and shunning each other, even on the family level. It's an externalization of that anxiety. Then the internalization of that anxiety might look more like depression, might look more like fatigue and other kinds of malaise, which is more the way I had been experiencing it, is that when my anxiety kicks in, I just get really tired. And I've noticed over this period that even though I'm not doing a lot of exertion, I get tired at periods of the day and I just want to sleep. And I always feel better after the sleep, so I allow it. But it's a new behavior. It's more than just taking a nap. It's an anxiety response. If I'm worried about something, if something is going on that creates a stressor, my response is to want to go to sleep. And then when I push through that, because I have to work, I do things, I work with people, I find that I push through the sleep, and that leads me into a kind of depression or malaise where it becomes hard to feel motivated. And so I'll be working on a project, and then I'll start getting tired, and then I'll start napping. And then as I push through it, then I start getting more depressed. Then I start working on the depression and the anxiety, and I pull it up again. So it becomes a cycle, and it can be debilitating on a lot of levels. And I think for people who don't have tools to deal with it, it can be extremely debilitating. And so that's what I wanted also to think about today, to really just give some clues or some little exercises that we can do to short circuit that build up from the parasympathetic nervous system and begin to reprogram the parasympathetic nervous system and the narrative that we have stored in our brain that causes us, that we go back to, of danger, something's wrong, I need to protect myself. And so for me, part of that was getting to the root of it. So with all that storyline of what was happening in the world and the insecurity and the changing narratives and all that had its impact, but what had its most impact was my personal experience. So I started to relate to that in context. So one of the exercises that you can do, because the nerve cells are in the face, you know, they're all in the face, and they control our features or read our features. So if your body happens to be frowning, you're frowning, the nervous system is going to send back to the brain, uh-oh, something's up. Or if you're faces tight, that's going to send back to the brain, you know, something is building here. If your shoulders are tight and hunched and you don't have any opening in your neck and everything is tense in the neck and shoulders, that's a signal to the brain that you're in danger. And so what we can do is to begin to relax through the face and the throat and the upper chest using self-massage, as well as we can do humming. So when you're humming, it creates a tone in your throat and in your head that calms the nervous system. And we can also use laughter or toning coming from the lower body, and that begins to bring the nervous system back into balance. So while I've always have been doing these techniques, I started combining them with the core of my anxiety, which was grief from losing a brother, worry over a brother who's still quite sick but recovered, and worry over another younger brother who hasn't been impacted, but he has health issues. And I suppose thinking about my own vulnerabilities, such as they are, I'm probably healthier than my brothers by far, but that doesn't render me immune, because stress is what brings you closer to vulnerability in disease. And so this nervous system has also been connected to different psychological problems. It's connected to digestive problems. And it's connected to a lot of physiological issues rise out of having a system that is not functioning properly. It leads the vagus nerves are connected to inflammation in the body, connected to satiety or hunger. It's connected to fullness. It's connected to energy metabolism. So this is our feedback system that lets the brain know what the body is in trouble based on the signals it's reading. And what we have to do, therefore, is to retrain our brain, the subbrain and the conscious brain, that it's not a signal of being in danger, but it's a signal for having to pull it down, having to respond to it, so that we need to have a consciousness about what's going on as we're doing our exercises, so that we can retrain the brain and repattern the brain to understand that we're not living in a primitive world where we need be concerned of tigers, bears, but we're in a more advanced world where there is an environment of chaos that's creating this anxiety, and we can't quell it by lifting the anxiety level, which is what happens, because it's the fight or flight. So your anxiety goes up, your hormones go up, and you have to act quickly or deal with the situation. And we want to train our brain to understand dealing with the situation is calming the vagus nervous system. So because we have all of these nerve endings in our face, one of the things that we can do is to stroke the face. So it's not so much massage or deep tissue massage. It's more of a gentle stroking, as if you were petting your cat or your dog. It's a gentle, loving stroke that you are sharing your compassion and your love and your all that you have for your animals, that it's easy for us to give to them. It's much harder for us to do that for ourselves. So if you just were to take a few fingers and stroke up the bridge of your nose, up towards the region of your third eye, and just gently stroke. But as you're stroking, we also want to breathe. So bring yourself into a comfortable breathing pattern where you're breathing in gently, exhaling gently, and just gently stroking up the nose. Another set of nerves are along the outer rim of the eyebrows. So you can gently stroke, maybe starting at the middle, and just trace your eyebrows from the center towards the temples. Remember to breathe. And then gently using all of your fingers, just massage the temples. Remember to breathe. And just lay both hands on your face, on both sides. You know, think in terms of reaching out to your child or a loved one and taking their head in your hands, and we do that for ourselves, just taking the head into our hands, with the hands extending slightly on both sides. And open your eyes, and you want to see the edge of both hands, and then look to one side for 30 seconds or so. And look to the other side for 30 seconds or so. And do that a couple of times. Staying within your comfort zone, breathing comfortably, but never holding the breath, just breathing comfortably in and out. And what that does is it begins to relax the nerves around the eyes. And we can stroke along the eyes. But an even better thing would be to just stroke up the cheeks into the temple, starting down by the jaw, putting fingers on both sides of your chin, and just gently stroke up your face towards the temple. You know, and this is a very loving gesture you might do to a friend or a child, gently stroking the face. And also, these nerve endings go into the ears. You know that little flap in front of your ear? So we want to stroke that, but not press, just stroking the skin, putting one hand in front of the ear and one finger in front of the ear and another finger behind the ear, and just stroke up gently to calm the nerves in the ears. And another good thing is to smile, because smiling sends a signal that you are doing okay. So we're not advocating a fake smile, but just do a soft smile, turning the lips out, opening the face a bit, relaxing the muscles. And that begins to deliver to the brain that everything's going to be okay. We can get through it, we can manage it. And then coming through the neck, you can stroke down from the neck, from the jaw, stroking across the jaw and down into the neck. And that's just a few of the things that we can do. There are more, but I also wanted to touch on humming and toning. So you're in the privacy of your own space. Just allow yourself to hum for a few minutes, allowing the humming to be resonant enough that you can feel that vibration in your throat and in your face and in your head and in your brain. And just do a few hums. Just allow that vibration to resonate through your body. And humming is something that we do naturally. You know, when we're working or we're moving through something, humming could actually help to relax the nervous system, and that's one of its functions. Yawning also helps to relax the nervous system. So you could open your mouth like a yawn and just do a few sighing yawns, just opening the mouth. You know, those yawns. And sometimes that helps to relieve some of the tension in the body and around the mouth. And another thing that we can do is to tone. And we tone with the lower body. So the toning is more effective in impacting the nervous system in the lower body, you know, connecting to the digestion and the intestines. So toning can also be a very powerful factor in relaxing the nervous system. And toning is easy enough. It's like doing an om, but do it from down and deep in your body. Om. And there's a little bit of humming in that tone as well, or ringing you could do. Om. But make the sound with the lower body, allowing your voice to go deep and engaging the musculature of your lower body so that your diaphragm is moving with that tone and everything in the lower body is being toned with your sound. Another sound that I like, it comes from the Qigong practice. It's song, S-O-N-G. And its meaning is that it's establishing a golden beam of light between the center of the earth, the center of the cosmos, and your beingness, bringing a unity to earth, human, and cosmos, or heaven. It brings it together. And you use the tone song. So it's a little bit of a hissing at the top of it, which is a little bit of a kundalini sound. Then you go into a full O. And you close it with a ringing sound as much as possible, which is like the sound of a bell. And so it brings this tone to your body and it begins to balance your emotions and your nervous system. And it draws in that healing energy of the earth and cosmos into the process. So try a few of those tones of song. Song. Before running out of time, I also want to bring out breathing, because breathing is something you could do in any moment in time where you're being triggered by something. So say you're a young black man driving a car and a police pull up behind you. You're going to be triggered. So, but in order to not go into that fight or flight mode, the thing you can do immediately is to engage in a breath process that will calm your nervous system. And there's a technique called square breathing where you inhale, hold, exhale, hold, inhale, hold. And you can start tiny because maybe you're nervous. So it's inhale for two, hold for two, exhale for two, hold for two. And then you gradually deepen it. Inhale for three and go through four of three. And then you deepen it to four. And then you deepen it to five. And you just keep it regular. It doesn't have to be deep. You just want it to be a calm breathing process, even if it's just one count. So the idea is to use the count and the breathing to calm the nervous system. And the amygdala are going to be of this whole system is going to be sending back messages to your brain. Okay, we're calming down. I don't have to keep sending messages of panic. And then you bring yourself into a state where you can more readily deal with what's going on around you. And so those are just some clues. It went a little long, so we'll come back to this next time, and I'll take some of your questions about it. So please tune in to Heart of Mind Radio for the new millennium next week. We'll go through a little deeper process, and in that way, you will be able to really, really get things under control. So stay tuned.
Brighter day.